is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Hardly a week goes by now that you don't hear about the gene for a disease being found or news about biotechnology or cloning. So the news that the basic structure of DNA was first understood just 50 years ago today might come as a bit of a surprise, but it's true. On this date back in 1953, the patrons of a pub in Cambridge, England, learned that two researchers, James Watson and Francis Crick, had puzzled out the structure of the DNA molecule, beating several other researchers to the punch. Their work would be published a few months later in the journal Nature, but it was 50 years ago today that Francis Crick walked into the pub and announced that the researchers had, quote, found the secret of life. So this hour we'll be talking about the discovery, what went into it, who else was involved. We'll be talking about where biology and genetics have gone since then. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Victor McElhenney is a science writer and author of the new book, Watson and DNA, Making a Scientific Revolution, published by Perseus. He hails from Cambridge, Massachusetts, the other Cambridge, but he's here in our studios in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Nice to be here, Ira.
Kathy Hudson is the director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center, part of the Berman Bioethics Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Formerly, she was an assistant director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, and she joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Hudson.
Thank you.
Vic, set the scene for us. 50 years ago today, what was going on?
Well, Jim had been doing a lot of work on the structure, and he'd actually made some cardboard cutouts of the so-called bases that link the two strands of DNA in the late afternoon of the 27th of February. And then he went off to the theater, as he had agreed to do. And the next morning, somewhat uncharacteristically early, he came into the little teeny office that he and Francis Crick shared and got going trying to match up these little cardboard cutouts. And lo and behold, after a while, he found the right matches. Something called A would match up with something called T, and something called C would match up with something called G. And they looked, those two linked pairs looked the same. He was pretty ecstatic, and his roommate Donahue from Caltech came in. Jim asked him whether there was anything wrong with it, and Donahue had just corrected him in a most fundamental way the day before, and Donahue couldn't see anything the matter with it. Then Crick arrives. Jim runs to the door, practically grabs Crick, and tells him the equivalent of "We've got it." Crick then proceeds to examine whether he agrees with that, and he agrees that they've probably got it. And they also are ecstatic because what they'd got explained how DNA could be the molecule of heredity.
And so how does it get to the pub?
Well, it was by that time kind of late morning, and so they stroll over to the Eagle, where they had been eating practically every day for almost a year and a half, talking furiously all the time about DNA and about genes. They just loved talking with each other, mm-hmm. and they would walk along the river and then go to the pub.
So he walks in and says, "Hey, by the way, folks, you know, we just found the secret of life."
Well, Crick, of course, says he doesn't remember saying that. Uh-huh. He also recalls that he told his wife, Odile, that this was being said, and she said, "Oh, you say that all the time. I paid no attention."
So this news is greeted with a tremendous roar, right?
Actually, it's greeted with near silence. The first newspaper article about it doesn't appear until after their first paper is published in a London newspaper. The New York Times doesn't really get to it until June. The number of people in science who really dug this was numbered in dozens, I would say.
Kathy Hudson, what did their work actually describe? How much did scientists know about DNA before this? What was the meat of this discovery?
Well, the meat of the discovery was understanding the structure, and by understanding the structure, it's fairly evident, was certainly evident to Watson and Crick, the process by which this molecule could be replicated and thereby transmitted into subsequent generations. DNA was known to be the molecule of inheritance prior to Watson and Crick's discovery of its structure, and there was certainly, from Mendel's time on, an understanding of discrete units of heredity or genes.
Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, if you want to join in our discussion. So they knew that there was a molecule, but understanding the structure was important. Why? So they could figure out how it reproduces, how it zips apart and goes back together again, Kathy?
Well, if you have the structure in hand, then it makes it amenable to further study, and certainly that has been a rich source of discovery for scientists in the past 50 years. And because of its double helical structure, it was and because an A always pairs with a T and a C with a G, mm-hmm. if you peel those two strands apart and then copy them with their complement, it was obvious to Watson and Crick that this was then the mechanism by which genes could be effectively transmitted from one generation to the next generation. Having that chemical structure in hand then allowed scientists to develop ways of manipulating that molecule in the test tube and being able to determine the precise sequence and the meaning of that sequence, understanding that three letters of DNA coded for a specific amino acid, the building block of proteins, and being able to discern what are the stretches of DNA that that make up individual genes or individual instructions that tell our bodies to do the right thing at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Vic, very little of science ever goes on in a vacuum. Other people must have been competing with Watson and Crick.
Well, they were, including the very famous chemist Linus Pauling, whose birthday this is, incidentally. He died some years ago. And he entered this field. He was a past master at building models of molecules. He had done some pretty fantastic things only a short while before in the structure of proteins. He barges into this subject. It's sort of the next mountain from his point of view. He actually proposed a structure, a three-stranded structure, briskly sent it off to the National Academy of Sciences proceedings. Watson and Crick saw the manuscript of this paper late January, and that is one of the things that kicked them into high gear. They saw the paper, and they saw that it was wrong, and they figured that they only had a few weeks before Pauling discovered his mistake.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about someone who does not get mentioned a lot in this discovery, and that's Rosalind mm-hmm. Franklin.
Yes, well, while this is going on, Rosalind Franklin is getting ready to leave King's College London, where she was really quite unhappy, and she'd already settled on her next job. She was working during this same frantic month of February 1953, also working, kind of finishing off her DNA work. Her notebooks show that she was getting very close to the answers that Watson and Crick reach. She was it was close, but no cigars. She wasn't quite there. She closed her notebook at the end of February 1953, just days before Watson and Crick had their eureka moment.
And she actually was what they call a crystallographer. She took the final picture, the key picture of what the molecule looked like, correct?
She had taken the picture that inspired Jim. He happened to see this picture because Maurice Wilkins showed it to him at the end of January. That picture is a beautiful picture of DNA, of the wet extended form of it called the B form. She had taken that picture the previous May, laid it aside, and continued her studies of the other form of DNA, and she was getting ready to leave, so she'd handed over these materials to Wilkins. Wilkins showed the picture to Jim.
Kathy, do you think that she was short shrifted on this, on the credit for this?
I think it's hard to know, looking back through the decades of time, to know what sort of credit she should have been attributed and whether or not she was treated fairly or not. Certainly, it appears, maybe others know more clearly than I do, whether or not she actually was even aware that her photographs were being shown to others and were being mm-hmm. Used by others. Wilkins certainly was credited with the Nobel Prize for the discovery of DNA.
We should mention that Rosalind Franklin died only about 5 years later after having done some notable work on viruses, doing which she actually became somewhat more friendly with both Crick and Watson, who were interested in the same things.
So she could not have won the prize because she was deceased, and no one who is deceased can win the prize.
That's true, and there would also have been kind of a nice calculation in 1962 when the prize was given, whether it should have been her or Wilkins to share in it. The Nobel rule is only three.
1-800-989-8255. Vic, you write about a lot about Watson, and it's titled, your book is titled Watson and DNA Making a Scientific Revolution. What was it about Watson and Crick that made them, that drove them, that got them there first before Pauling and other people?
Well, I think they were much more obsessively concentrated. They were young, cocky, mold-breaking people. So they were smart alecks. They were also focused on the gene more than just on the structure. They were obsessively talking about it all the time. They focused on it very hard. Francis Crick has said, yes, we stumbled on gold, but we were looking for gold.
Let's see if I can get a call in before we go to the break. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Arthur in Alameda, California. Hi, Arthur.
Hi. Here's my question. Would you and your guests speculate on what the impact on the discovery would have been had the system of patenting, which is now in effect, for example, the patenting in the Genome Project, been in effect upon Crick and Watson, and would they have been able to make the discovery? And what if they had patented it, just in case, which as far as I know they didn't? I just read this very good book about Seymour Benzer, the founder of microbiology, and he didn't patent anything, and he was inspired by Arrowsmith, the figure in Sinclair Lewis's novel, which was one of ideas.
We're going to run out of time.
Okay, go ahead.
Kathy, can you give us a reaction?
Well, it's an interesting question of whether or not having a patent on the structure of DNA would have been considered to be patentable subject matter. I think still today, the issue of whether or not DNA in its various forms is patentable and whether or not that has fair or unfair consequences for ultimately the end user, the patients who are going to be using these DNA inventions, that's still a very active area of debate in the scientific and biotechnology communities.
Okay. Yeah, in 1953, June, a famous scientist named Szilard spoke to Jim about the idea of patenting DNA, and Watson actually rejected that idea. He thought that there was nothing useful about the discovery, and you have to be useful to have a patent.
There was nothing useful about it.
not in anyone's view then. This was a theory, and it had to do with fundamental life processes, and the medical significance of it was not.
And how long did it take to know that was wrong, that view?
I mean, whether you could patent genes.
Well, that it was a useful discovery.
I think that really took shape over a number of years. The idea wasn't really definitively proven until about 5 years later by a very complicated experiment. I think by the 1960s, it was understood.
That's interesting. We're going to have to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk lots more with our guest, Vickle McElhenney, science writer and author of the book Watson and DNA, Making a Scientific Revolution, Kathy Hudson, director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center, and we'll be joined after a break with David Baltimore, so stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the 50th anniversary of DNA with my guest, Victor McElhenney, author of Watson and DNA, Making a Scientific Revolution, Kathy Hudson, director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center. That's part of the Berman Bioethics Institute at Johns Hopkins University. And joining me now for at least a few moments is Dr. David Baltimore, Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine in 1975, now the president of the California Institute of Technology, Caltech in Pasadena. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Baltimore.
Hello, and how are you?
How are you? You know, I found it interesting, but right before the break, Victor McElhenney was telling us that it was not immediately recognized how important this discovery was.
Well, molecular biology in those days was not exactly on everybody's tongue the way it is today. I mean, today DNA is in the crossword puzzles, but in those days It was only the province of a very small number of people. And so there weren't many people to recognize how important it was. But I think a lot of the key people did.
Mm-hmm. Your Nobel Prize was for work in 1970 connecting the information in DNA and RNA through an enzyme called reverse transcriptase.
Right.
That was 17 years after the double helix structure was found. Why so long? Not to cast out any of your work. But
it took... I mean, the experiments that I actually did were biochemistry, and it took a number of years before the biochemistry of DNA got to the point where you could even do the experiment. But then you had to think to look in a very unlikely place, which was in the particles of a cancer-inducing virus, to find the enzyme that reversed the flow of information from RNA back to DNA. And nobody would have thought to look there, except for the work of Howard Temin, who was a great experimentalist and thinker, died unfortunately a number of years ago, and shared the Nobel Prize with me. And he had made the suggestion that there might be something like this going on. And so we took a look and found it, but really would not have imagined to do that kind of experiment any earlier than that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone. Some interesting calls from our listeners. 1-800-989-8255. Rich in Indiana. Hi, Rich.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, go ahead.
I just wondered what your guests would think about if that same discovery was made today, 50 years later, and look at, like you have already talked about, patents and all of this. Would it ever have come to light as fast as what it did 50 years ago? And what is all this going to do to ongoing portions of this program, like the human genome? I mean, we've already seen where the private sector and the government sector are arguing and fighting over who gets funds and who does what. You know, how is all this economic situation, I guess, today going to affect the science of this?
David, let me ask you first.
Well, you know, today we have sort of instant science understanding. People like Ira Flatow hear about something and it becomes known through NPR. It's in the press. The kind of interest in science that we see, particularly because of the commercial exploitation possibilities, is enormous. So a discovery like that would be known instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And would be discussed everywhere.
Would it have been patented, do you think, today?
Would it have been what?
Today, would it be patented? Would the discovery, the structure, have been patented?
Somebody would try to patent it, for sure. But, you know, patenting has not really held up basic research. It does limit commercial development, but it also activates commercial development.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes both ways.
Okay.
But... there would be no problem in the basic research community. We would be exploiting it instantly. I mean, there's been a recent discovery of something called RNAi. It's an interfering RNA molecule, little RNA molecule, and you can make these things to order and target any gene you want. So you can knock out the expression of any gene you want. The day that those papers were published, people started working on adapting it to their own particular system.
Mm-hmm.
It's instant communication and instant exploitation of new opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, you have a comment?
I do. Rich's question was really about whether or not if we discovered DNA today and it was patented, would it be kept secret? And in fact, it's an integral part of the patent system that there is disclosure of the invention. So if DNA were discovered today, we would all know about it if it were patented because of that system. I'd also like to point out that with the Human Genome Project, there certainly was controversy between the private sector effort and the publicly funded effort. The publicly funded scientists had a real devotion to immediately releasing all of the DNA sequence information that was made available and not filing patent applications on that sequence, and that policy has been expanded since it was adopted initially and is still in place today.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. People have been told over and over again that DNA is the blueprint for life, that we are who we are, it's written in our genes. Do you think that DNA has been oversold a bit in the last, Vic, let me start with you, in the last 50 years, people say, well, you know, it's in our DNA. They don't think too much about the nurture part of the nature equation.
Well, I guess DNA, the structure, really changed the scientific conversation, you know, gradually, mm-hmm. so that biology became something very different from what it had been before. It was clear that life was, in a certain sense, molecular. Some of these issues about what use you would make of it show up in the very first news stories about DNA. I mean, there was a headline, "Why You Are You," in the News Chronicle of London in May of 53. So people have been, you know, thinking about what this would do to them. An awful lot of that is music of the future.
David, do you have any comment on that?
No, I mean, I think that's right. There's no question that we are moving towards a view of human life in which genes play a very important part. And that has been a movement since the discovery of the structure of DNA and the whole development of molecular biology and the sequencing of the genome, which has shown us how similar we are to other organisms, indicating that there are things at work here that have been genetically programmed for eons. And I would say that we're probably in one of those pendulum swing situations in which there may be more emphasis now on genes and less on the environment, and then it'll go back the other way. But there's no question it's an interaction. Mm-hmm. And you take a look at two identical twins. They're very similar to look at. They're very similar to talk to. But they're doing different things in life. They have different niches that they've found. They have different opinions. They have different friends. That's a very good measure of the differences that an environment can play on a common genetic background.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, you were formerly at the National Human Genome Research Institute. We keep hearing that the Genome Project is scheduled to release its complete, full, final wrap-up of the project in the next few months. Where do we stand on that?
At the time when the working draft was announced in June of 2000, about 20% of the human genome sequence had been finished and was in a high-quality final form. Where we are today is that 95% of the genome, 95% of those 3 billion letters, have been decoded and are in a highly accurate form and available for all researchers to use in order to understand human health and human disease and our relationship to other creatures on Earth.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. Let's go to Sarah in Bluebell, Pennsylvania. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a very basic question, and I hope it's okay. But I don't understand exactly what a gene is. I know that DNA is a molecule, and I don't understand whether genes are part of that molecule or whether the molecules make up genes.
Mm. Raise your hand if you want to answer that question. Vic, you want to take a shot?
Well, the genes appear to be written in sequence along the DNA. They're actually, just to make things more complicated, chopped up into pieces. Many human genes which are along that stretch of DNA are chopped up into pieces that are eventually expressed as a single message. But your basic question is whether the genes are in DNA, and they are.
So you have DNA that's made up into little bits that have a trait that goes into it, becomes a gene, or has a characteristic that we call genes.
Yes, there's
right,
some.
Go ahead.
Kathy, go ahead. Your turn.
So DNA is a very long strand, a very long molecule, and there are segments or stretches along it, say 3,000 letters long, that contain a specific instruction to make a specific protein or maybe more than one protein. And it's the stretch from point A to point B along that very long DNA molecule that we call a gene. What precisely a gene is and where it starts and where it ends is actually subject to some discussion, because there are elements outside of the long distances in some cases from the actual message that dictate when a particular gene will be expressed and how much of it will be made. So the regulatory elements are sort of packaged in with the gene, and that may be an even longer segment of DNA. But basically, a gene is an information coding segment of DNA.
Sarah, do you get that?
I think I do.
Great. Then we've done our job today.
Yeah, I think you got to say one more thing. That the more we learn about genes, the less we know how to define them.
Exactly.
They're broken up in pieces. One piece of DNA, which we call a gene, actually has many different products. Some of these products do one thing. Some of these products do another thing. They're controlled in different ways. The concept of the gene has become a very fluid one, and although you can describe it as it has been described as a stretch of DNA that encodes a protein, it's really much more complex and interesting than that.
Okay.
At least to some of us, it's more interesting than that.
But I don't want to confuse matters.
All right. I hope you got there. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Why has it taken now almost 50 years for us to decode the human genome? Was there something, David, about the technology, something about the state of science? What is it? What it took so
Well,
long?
The technology was a big thing. We were prepared once the methods of sequencing DNA came along, which is now back in the 70s, if I have it right. We were prepared to sequence little pieces of DNA, but to sequence a whole genome required automated technology, and I got to give Caltech credit here, my institution, because Lee Hood, when he was here in the 70s and then in going into the mid-80s, developed the technology to do this. And he developed it when the scientific community really thought it wasn't a terribly interesting thing to do, because most people were perfectly satisfied with rudimentary technology. But he said, we need to take this thing to a new level. And so he automated the process, and that automation allowed the sequencing of the human genome. It had to be then commercially developed further by the companies that built the sequencers.
Well, one of the key moments in the history of genetics was the Asilomar Conference, at which scientists discussed, frankly, the ethics of what they were doing and whether they should stop doing what they were doing. Do you think? I know you were actively involved in that, do you think it's time for another conference like that?
I don't think you can have another conference like that, because that conference was based on the notion that we had a safety problem. We had to understand whether we were going to create organisms in the laboratory that could be dangerous to the society. It wasn't an ethical problem. It wasn't a moral problem. It was a safety issue. And scientists could get together and discuss very effectively whether that was a serious safety issue, a not so serious safety issue, how to move ahead in a balanced way so that we introduce these technologies in a safe manner. And that's what we did. The kinds of issues that we're facing today are much more moral and ethical issues about stem cells, about embryos, about abortions, and those are not the province of science to discuss necessarily. Scientists have to be involved in those discussions because we probably know better the technical details. But in the end, they're much more societal problems and couldn't be handled by just a scientific group getting together at Asilomar again.
Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I see Kathy is chomping at the bit to get in. Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, I think that there are very challenging issues that we face as the science advances, and I think that David Baltimore is quite correct that this is not these are not issues that are appropriate just for scientists to consider, although I think scientists have an important role to play. But I think that a much broader swath of the American public needs to be engaged and involved in discussions about what are the applications of these technologies, which technologies are bringing forth societal problems that we need to address either through government regulation or through professional standards or through education and information, both for health providers and for the public. And these are very challenging issues that we're facing today that many of the public, members of the public, are not really adequately prepared to deal with.
Victor?
I just wanted to point out that the Asilomar meeting was a landmark in making a discussion among scientists available to the public. There were 16 members of the press there. I was one of those. That really carried the scientific discussion out into a much more public forum, and I think that expresses the fact that the public needs to come into a lot of these things sooner than it used to.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. Is it possible to, with a crystal ball, Dr. Baltimore, to say where the next milestone is going to come? Or where you would like, where is the next big challenge that would make a milestone?
Well, you know, we in my community generally feel that if something's going to be a breakthrough, you can't know about it beforehand, because otherwise it wouldn't be a breakthrough.
That's the good answer. Now,
right. But
then tell us what the problems in the way are.
That being said, as I look forward, what I see us doing is exploiting the information in the genome, developing new drugs, new targets for drugs, much more exact medicine pharmaceutically. But what I really see now on the horizon are new kinds of therapy that come out of new technologies that we can join to genetics, particularly cellular therapies and gene therapy, things which have been very difficult to develop, which have been slow to develop, but which I believe are a very important part of the future that biotechnology can provide to medicine. So that's where I'm looking for really exciting things to happen over the next decade.
Do we have the tools to get there?
We have a lot of tools. We develop the tools when we need them often. This new discovery of RNAi that I mentioned earlier is an incredibly a powerful tool that we didn't have 2 years ago, and that today is central to our thinking. So who knows what's in the offing of that sort.
Well, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk a little bit more about this. We have to say goodbye to David Baltimore. And thank you very much, Dr. Baltimore, for taking time to talk with us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be able to talk with you.
You're welcome. Dr. David Baltimore, 1975 Nobel laureate in physics or medicine and now president of Caltech in Pasadena, California. We're talking for the next few minutes this hour today about the anniversary of the discovery of the structure of DNA and where that has taken science with Victor McElhenney, author of Watson and DNA, Making a Scientific Revolution, Kathy Hudson, director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center, part of the Berman Bioethics Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Victor, your book really is a character study of Watson. What intrigued you about him?
Well, I think that a character study like that is really necessary to sort of understand this incredibly rapid development of biology over the last 50 years. And Watson appeals to me partly because he's smart, but also because he's tremendously influential. He has taught thousands of scientists ways of thinking about this. He's a very outspoken, pushing kind of person. Out at Cold Spring Harbor today, the Nobel Prize winner Sidney Brenner told me that the best word to describe him is an instigator.
We don't hear very much from Crick these days. We tried to get him to come on the program. I understand he's ill and he does not make many personal appearances.
Right, and he's 86 years old and he's also uncomfortable with the kind of high-voltage publicity world where Jim Watson seems totally comfortable.
Kathy, any comment?
No.
Have you met either one of them, Vic? Was Watson available to you for writing the book? Was he?
No, Jim and I guess, kind of agreed that I wouldn't mess up his head and he wouldn't mess up mine. So I did not do interviews with him or with Crick. What I did do was to talk to about 50 people, many of them very leading scientists who had worked with him.
Kathy, this is being celebrated here with galas in New York, other cities. Very, very exciting time.
It is a very exciting time. There are parties and museum exhibits looking at the scientific implications of all of this discovery around DNA, the medical consequences of these discoveries, and interesting looks at the societal implications, exhibits in New York and in other cities looking at art that has been inspired by DNA and genetics.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank you both for joining us this hour. Victor McElhenney is the science writer and author of a new book, Watson and DNA, Making Scientific Revolution, published by Perseus. I recommend it. Kathy Hudson, director of the Genetics and Public Policy Center, part of the Berman Bioethics Institute at Johns Hopkins University, and she formerly was an assistant director of the National Human Genome Research Institute. Thank you both for taking time to talk with us today.
Great to be
Thank
here.
Thank you.
And happy birthday to all of you.